The Theosophical Society presents N. Sri Ram in a talk entitled The Nature of Consciousness, Part 2.
I was speaking of the essential nature of consciousness 2 days ago. The essential nature of consciousness is to be conscious and nothing more. If you add anything more to the state of being conscious, then you are referring to something more than the essence. It is just to be conscious. But I indicated that there is no limit, so far as we can tell, to the extent, the depth, this consciousness, awareness, or sensitivity can go. I believe, this is just a belief, that the universe is so constituted that for everything that exists or takes place, there is a consciousness which is capable of perceiving it or following it. Something exists somewhere, an extremely subtle movement, something is taking place. There is a consciousness which can detect it, which can perceive it, which can follow the movement. Because on one side there is this capability of perception, on the other side there is that which is to be perceived, and the two are interrelated at every level. So there is no limit, as I said, to the degree to which one can be sensitive. I made that statement, but it can give rise to misunderstanding, so I want to modify it. I deliberately made the statement in order that I may modify it. When we say one can be sensitive, it doesn't mean I myself as I am. It means there is a nature in me which can be sensitive. And that when that nature comes into play, then one is truly oneself. Now, consciousness is of the essence of life. Now that sounds sententious, but suppose you look at a flower or you look at a tree. It is conscious. I think it is Wordsworth who said, "I believe that every flower that lives enjoys the air it breathes." Even plants, not to speak of birds, animals, insects, everything that is alive experiences the joy of living. It feels, it experiences, it responds, it has a certain intelligence. And the intelligence works in ways which are not understood by us, and which we can never understand fully by observation from outside. It is only when you enter into the consciousness of the butterfly, you will know how it feels. What is the joy in the movement of its wings? In what way it feels the poise of its body? How it is attracted to this and that? What it sees or does not see? We will not know the life in the butterfly, which means the conscious nature of the butterfly, unless in some way we try to enter into that consciousness, try to feel it, make yourself open to it, negative to it. If you approach that phenomenon with a positive mind full of ideas derived from various books and whatnot, you know, you can never understand. Ideas are always a barrier. Mr. Krishnamurti points it out very often, but you can see an idea is a positive front. You have this idea, there it is. You place it before you and you challenge all comers. That's what it is. You stand by it. You want to uphold it. Nobody dare deny or doubt it, or doubt its importance. That is our attitude in life. But is it not possible to have a different attitude in which you have a heart? I would rather use the word heart than mind, which is open to everything that lives. So, if you can do that, you will see how every living thing, every plant, the blade of grass, the flower, is conscious in its own way, in its own degree. Life in every form has intelligence, as I said. It also acts, but it acts instinctually, not by thought, not by wavering between this and that, oscillating between one idea and another idea. That is our thinking, going to and fro, traversing the whole field, getting confused. It doesn't act in that way, but just by an instinct which is fixed and sure. So I will talk about that this evening. It responds. Every living thing, the earthworm responds, but in set ways. You know, its responses are limited and determined. And of course it experiences pain and also pleasure, the stimulation of pleasure, or the pleasure of stimulation, whatever you call it. If we can realize this fact and not merely take it as a statement to be entered into the notebook, then we will be much more in communion with life. We will have a respect for it which we do not feel. We will approach it with delicacy. We would be disinclined to hurt or injure any living creature. And that is why it is said in the old books that life in every form is divine. It comes from an extraordinary source. We cannot imagine it. And it has a beauty. It has an unearthliness, which we do not know when we see it in this limited form. And another fact, which is also of remarkable significance, is that life, we use the word life as though it is something just universal. It is universal, but it always assumes an individual form. It is not a kind of homogeneous ocean without any character. Perhaps it includes such a diversity of characters that we have to think of it in general terms. But it is always individual, individual in form, individual in character, individual in expression, individual as distinguished from everything else. When you come to a higher level, the level of what we perceive, then you see that beauty is always individual. Beauty sounds an abstract term, but it is something which is beautiful. It has a character. A picture is an individual thing. The beauty of it is defined. It arises from its composition. The beauty of it lies in the expression of the picture, what it conveys to you. Similarly with music or anything else. It is definite, it is individual, it is distinct, it is different from anything else. It has its own beauty, so to say. So life is of the same nature. It is individual. And the consciousness of each living thing is at every point in the organization it uses. I spoke of a butterfly. The consciousness of the butterfly, whatever it might amount to, is at every point in the body of the butterfly. So with regard to ourselves, the consciousness is at every point. If anything goes wrong anywhere in the body, you feel it. It is only when everything beautifully fits with everything else, everything is in a state of harmony, that you are entirely unconscious of the bodily process, which shows that it is at every point. It is one with the process in that organization. If you think of the human body, it's an extraordinary process. The more you study this process, the more wonderful it becomes. The consciousness of the body is one with that process. Every living thing, further, when we use the word consciousness, it is receptive, but it can also act. This is obvious. We receive impressions and the mind also acts. Every living thing is not consciousness in general. Again, you think of some example. You think of some bird. It is not consciousness in general. Its consciousness is a particular kind of consciousness, a particularization of consciousness. You know, in these days we are fond of abstract terms, but let us not, in using abstract terms, become abstract ourselves. That is to say, abstract ourselves from life and reality. We are concerned with living, we are concerned with life, we are concerned with this world with which we are in touch. And it is easy to use a number of mathematical equations and symbols which may represent reality at some level, but when you go on working out your figures, you are oblivious of the external world. So the fact that we dwell in abstractions may cause us to lose contact with reality. There is something before you, it is wonderful. But I am engaged in manipulating my symbols, making drawings on my paper, so this wonder doesn't appeal to me. I just ignore it. You see how the mind abstracts itself. There is always a danger in abstractions. We may use them, but fully realizing that the abstraction, the symbol, the term, the word, merely stands for the reality. You must not mistake it for the reality. It is a substitute for the reality. It's a pointer towards it. And that is why when a set of terms become separated from the reality and we merely cast them about, they just become a jargon. Anything can become a jargon. Atma, buddhi, manas can become a jargon. The psychodynamic field and conceptual field and all the rest can become a jargon. Parabrahm can become a jargon. Anything can be made a jargon. Any word, then it is bereft of reality. But so we must always remember that we are concerned with what is real to us. Not with some abstract reality. You use some word, that is the real. You have only used a word. God knows what concept you have in your mind, but even that is a mere abstraction. It is just a figure, two lines or something like that, or just a little flutter in the brain. That is not the reality. So we must always be concerned with the real. I said that the other day, I think, that occultism is concerned with reality, not with fancy, not with abstraction, not with just words, not with symbols, and so forth. Now, when you think of a living thing, you see, it has a certain instinct. Even the earthworm has an instinct. And the consciousness of the earthworm is an adaptation of consciousness. It has been molded in a certain way. It has a certain character. It has certain tendencies. Every plant has certain tendencies. It will grow only in a certain way. It is stained with experience. Life in every living form, or rather, the consciousness which pertains to every living form, is stained with experience. And it has certain psychic properties. Properties which belong to the nature of consciousness and how it is affected. That is psychic. Psyche seems a convenient word to use. You have to refer to this. It is that consciousness in a particular form which has an instinct, which has certain tendencies, which has drunk of some experience, or drunk with experience, I don't know what you call it. It has a certain psychic property or quality. You can say magnetism. It has a certain magnetism. So psyche is a convenient word to use. Another term for it is, it is the kama manasik soul. I hope you don't mind my using such a long word. You know, kama manas, the desire mind. It is the soul. The word soul is used variously. There is the animal soul, there is the human soul, there is the spiritual soul. It is only one soul. But these three souls refer to three different conditions of the soul, or three different aspects of the soul, if the conditions exist at the same time. So there is this kama manasik soul, the psyche of the Greeks, you know. An artist would probably paint some kind of a butterfly, let me say, and say this is the psyche. It just a suggestion of its characteristics is in that picture. And life, of course, is always dynamic. There is nothing more dynamic than life, because it exists from everlasting to everlasting. It expands, it grows, it reproduces its kind, it changes from moment to moment, and changes not arbitrarily but by causation, law of cause and effect. And it also evolves, it produces a new species which is more wonderful, which has superior capacities, which is of a superior type, which is an extraordinary process. How does this evolution take place? The scientist speaks of evolution. Surely it takes place through the downpouring or infiltration, whatever word you want to use, of energies which lie outside the field of the evolving form. There is a certain form, it evolves, it presents a different aspect, new faculties, new capacities. And this form has been changing all the time during its existence. It has been changing according to the law of cause and effect. But out of this, how did this superior form arise? The effect of a cause cannot go beyond the cause. The effect is already in the cause. But there is something you find which is not in the cause. At least not in the cause as we perceive that cause. So the energies come from somewhere outside the evolving form. Another way of saying it is that there is the divine idea. The idea in the divine mind, the archetype. There is an archetypal form hovering invisibly over the visible form. And this archetypal form is not something absolutely unconnected. There is a subtle connection. And there are energies streaming from that archetypal form into the form as it exists, and therefore the form evolves in a particular way. I think it is clear, the picture is clear. You look at a rose. It's extraordinarily beautiful. But it wasn't always the same kind of rose. It was a different kind of flower. Perhaps in the process of evolution, there may be a more extraordinary rose. We cannot say anything about it. But it seems to be in the nature of things. Something more wonderful than the rose or any other thing that you can think of. Now, how is this approximation to a certain perfection which you notice in the evolutionary process, how does it take place? The perfection is there. It is invisibly there. It presides over the evolutionary process. So you see, in every living thing, there is consciousness, but with a character and an action, which you can say shows it, its nature, its psyche. And there is also a dynamism, there is action. It pulsates, it throbs, it responds, it evolves. So life is psychodynamic. You see that it is perfectly simple. It is just the phenomenon which you perceive. The two words psycho and dynamic, to some extent, analyze the process that takes place. On the one side it is psyche, on the other side it is dynamism. In other words, energy and a form of consciousness. So we mustn't just, in using words, forget that they all refer to actual things, to what there is, what is taking place. Now this life, according to occultism, is everywhere. HPB says that there is no particle of dust which is devoid of life. Now, of course, in the dust, there is not life as we see it or as we know it. Not as you see it in a plant, in an animal. But is it not possible that there may be a quality of livingness, so to say, in all things? There may be a quality of livingness in the whole expanse which we call space. Maybe we don't know the nature of the universe in its ultimates. We do not know it. All this is partly speculation, partly observation, partly inference, partly what we derive from people who apparently know about these things a great deal. But when all is said and done, probably there is an enormous more, if I may use the word. It's a quantitative word. Perhaps there are many things which we don't understand, which we don't perceive. That is why it is not so important to... What is important is not what we think, but how we think, how we perceive. To have a mind which is open, which is perceiving, which can go further, which is willing to learn, which is not entrenched in ideas, that kind of open mind, whether it be a domestic situation or any situation or science or philosophy, it is that kind of a mind which is necessary, not so much what you think. You know, we can fill our mind with ideas. They may be true enough. And another person may not have these ideas. But we don't necessarily become better in any fundamental sense than the person who does not know. He may have a quality of mind which is perhaps even better than mine. Although I have read a great deal, I know so much and all that, and can talk from a platform, the other person doesn't know all this. But you know, there may be the quality of the mind. So it is that which is important. How we think, how open we are, how reasonable we are, how sensitive we are in our thinking, which is important, because If there is such a mind, you will come to the truth. No books are necessary, you will find out. The eyes and the ears are open, well, you will come to the truth, as I said, you will know the truth. They say that Akasha is pregnant with life. Akasha is supposed to be one with space. It's a universal expanse. But it is pregnant with a living quality. It is iridescent, if I may say so, like an opal. Although the comparison may not be good. I have not seen the Akasha, you know, of course, very well. In every living body, there are a diversity of processes. You know, there is the circulatory system, respiratory system, nervous system, glandular system. I won't go further and betray my ignorance of physiology. But all these processes make a wonderfully coordinated complex. People like the word complex. They don't like something which is quite simple. So when you use the word complex, it sounds learned and has a certain appeal to the audience. Well, there is in that system of processes, which is quite a marvelous system. If you just know from any ordinary physiology book what takes place in the human body, you know what it is. There is a center of intelligence which achieves this coordination with electronic precision and swiftness. At every moment, the processes have to be coordinated. If there is a little failure in that, then the body is in trouble. So we begin to sneeze, or I don't know what we do, we send for a doctor perhaps. So there is a kind of electronic intelligence which is not the intelligence of the individual life, it is nature's intelligence. The universal intelligence, the divine intelligence, or it all amounts to the same thing. There are different words to denote different conceptions which all finally melt into one another. Now, this center of intelligence, it continues to act. And there is the continuation of the center throughout life, all the time coordinating these processes. It may be regarded as a kind of silver thread. You know, suppose you are able to see through the body. You suddenly develop a kind of clairvoyance which enables you to see beyond the skin. You see all these processes as they are pictured in any book on physiology, circulatory system and all the other systems. But you won't see any life there. You won't see this coordinating center. But there is something which coordinates. And it exists from moment to moment. So if you regard it as just a point and put various points representing different moments, then it's like a silver thread. Silver because it is shining. The word is merely used to bring out the fact that there is something which has a shining character. Now this thread is unbroken. And they use in Sanskrit a word which is sutratma, meaning thread self. But it refers to something higher up, but you see it also at this level. And in Light on the Path, referring to, I believe, human existence, statement in that essay on karma, every individual existence may be thought of as a rope stretching from infinity to infinity. You know, it's endless. What you are now is a product of what you were at the previous moment. What you were at the previous moment is a product of what existed at a moment still previous. So when you go back and back, where is the point from which you can start? Can you say, this is the point? There is nothing previous to that. Can you think of it like that? So from that point of view, this statement, from infinity to infinity, although it is not quite comprehensible to us, makes sense. Now, life is an energy, of course, obviously. It is an energy, it does so many things. And when there is motion, there is the movement of life from one state to another. It implies something moving. You think of the psyche, the consciousness of the living creature. There is a motion, a change. And this change must be produced by some psychic cause, psychic impulse. Psychic means pertaining to the realm of consciousness. It can only be desire or love. In every living thing there is a desire. It desires something. As I said the other day, there is in it the thirst for experience, the hunger for experience. And of course, there is satisfaction, but that is temporary. The hunger starts again. So we see there is this desire which moves it forward. If there is no desire, then suppose you have no desire for anything in life. You seek nothing, absolutely. No praise, no recognition, no acknowledgement, no sensation, no pleasure, no gratification, no honor. Then what is it which makes you act? Is there anything in life which will make you act when you are completely devoid of desire? The only thing which can impel you to action is love. If you feel love, then you act without any desire, seeking anything for oneself, without desiring the fruit of action, as the Bhagavad Gita says, nothing to come by, nothing to be gained, no profit, nothing commercial about it, but it's a spontaneous movement. So when there is this movement of the psyche, what is it which moves? Either desire or love. It is said in the Indian books that in the beginning, that is, the very origin of the cosmos, there was only the self-existent one. There is a Sanskrit word for that, but I won't inflict these terms on you. Well, in the beginning, they say desire arose. That is what you will find in the books. There was nothing to desire. How can desire is always based upon previous experience. You have experienced something. It was gratifying. You are attached to it. And there is a desire for the experiencing it again. You want to reproduce that sensation. So, but when there is nothing that went before, there is nothing to desire. When there is the plenum, the fullness of life, there is what is there for it to desire? There is no desire, no previous experience. But still, they use this word desire, probably because they couldn't find any other word for it. You know, the word eros has been used. But then we must remember that this eros has nothing to do with eroticism, any kind of lustfulness. Can you think of a desire without any object, or desire without a self? We desire something for ourselves. Can there exist a kind of desire with nothing to desire? Well, perhaps it's this eros which is symbolized. In all these matters, you know, you have to proceed. You can't be dogmatic. We are all students primarily. That is to say, we are learning to understand. And there must be that attitude all the time. So, life in each individual thing is an integrated stream of sensitivity and action. It flows like a stream, it's integrated. The rope consists of many strands, and there is all the time sensitivity of various sorts, and it is, there is also movement, there is action. When the consciousness, which is just being conscious, let me say again, is moved by desire, then I think it approximates to what we call the psyche. When there is that desire, the groping for something, but when it is moved by love, without any taint of self or desire, no, without the factor of egoism, then it is the soul in the spiritual sense. That, I think, is really the distinction between the soul in a pure sense. Now, life and consciousness are essentially of the same nature. When I say essentially, I mean in essence. But there is a distinction between them. The consciousness, as we see it in ourselves, becomes free of the organization. I am wearing a body. There is a certain consciousness which is one with the processes in the body. But now at the present moment, and I am talking to you, my consciousness is acting. But it is acting outside the processes of the body, of the organization. It just comes off the ground. You know, it's flying in the air. I hope it is flying meaningfully. It's unaware of the form which it uses. I am unconscious of my body. I am unconscious of the processes that take place. But this free consciousness, of course there is the limitation of the brain, but we will leave that apart. We are talking of consciousness not as limited by the brain, but as consciousness itself. This free consciousness, it limits itself by attachments in a state of unawareness. Apart from the limitation of the brain, you know, in itself it ought to be free, but it limits itself. It makes a movement, and that movement becomes a limitation. Suppose I put it this way. I think, when I think, I create a groove in my consciousness or brain, and then the tendency is to, for the energy of my consciousness to flow in that groove. So I tend to repeat what I said. You know, you are always creating grooves, ruts in our mind by the very process of thinking. But apart from that, that is something different. But there is the limitation by attachment. I form an idea, I get attached to it. When I get attached to it, it is as though there is a string between the center of consciousness and that idea which is floating in the waters of my consciousness. So when there are so many strings which tie you, I am attached to so many things. I am attached to my position. I am attached to my house. I am attached to what people think about me. I am attached to so many ideas because they suit me, they are congenial to me, they are pleasant for me. So when the consciousness becomes attached to different sensations, attached to coffee, attached to tea, attached to so many things that one eats. You see, all these attachments are formed when you are not aware of what is taking place. So in that state of unawareness, when there are so many attachments, when it is pegged down at so many points, it cannot move freely. So in that way, the whole movement of consciousness, its freedom becomes limited by its own action in a state of awareness, not knowing what is happening to it. This is our constant experience. We become a little aware of the way in which we get attached to things, then perhaps we will be free of them. We will be much freer within ourselves. Now, I said both life and consciousness are essentially of the same nature. They are both plastic. Life is fluidic. It adapts itself to its body. It adapts itself to the environment. It has an extraordinarily plasticity. But consciousness is infinitely more plastic. Or perhaps I should not say infinitely more. The correct way to say it is infinitely plastic. That becomes a more generalized description. But I think it is correct. Life is bound to the organization which it uses. The organization is like a tight-fitting dress. You know, sometimes people wear tights. They cling to the body, and then they cling so perfectly that the body is unconscious of this dress which is being worn. So the organization fits the consciousness so perfectly. But fits the life so perfectly. Now, consciousness is infinitely plastic. It can assume any form. Essentially, basically, it is like Akasha. But we don't know that essence. We are far from that basis. We are only thinking about it. Perhaps it is one with Akasha. I say perhaps, because we have to be very careful in our thinking in these matters. That is to say, it is so subtle. I mean the consciousness of a developed consciousness, a human being, is so subtle, so extraordinarily swift in action, so sensitive, with manifold possibilities of action, manifold resourcefulness, living, resonant, vibrant, when it has all these qualities which are associated with Akasha, we have to think of it as perhaps Akasha itself, but as you find it in the individual form, in the individual human being. So I think it is like Akasha, but the curious thing is it can also become like earth, like water, like fire. Like, I don't say it becomes. Solid like the earth. That is to say, it becomes fixed. You know, there are fixations in the mind. A person can become rock-like in his attitude. Nothing can change him. How is this consciousness, which is so fluid, how does it become not merely static, but solidified almost, petrified? You know, you must have come across people who are so flinty, who are absolutely unchangeable. You can produce no impression upon their minds. Well, to me it seems that they have just turned into rock inside them. Although there may be crevices in the lock through which the waters flow a little bit. Maybe that. But it is also like water, not only because of the fluidity, it has the capacity of transmitting pressure like water. You know, the modern psychologist knows very well that when pressure is applied in one direction, you know, water will find an outlet in another direction, wherever the outlet may be possible. So in the same way, when a person is pressed in one direction, he can take it out in another. Your wife may be treated brutally by the husband. She may be unable to rebel or get away from him. She probably takes it out on the child or on somebody else. This is a common phenomenon. You are angry with some person, you are unable to express that anger, you express it somewhere else. It is totally irrational. But you know, this thing, it is mechanical. It is only when it acts mechanically that these changes take place. And it can also be fired with love and enthusiasm and so forth. And further, it has this quality of expanding and contracting. That is to say, it can enlarge the field of awareness, take in very many things, or it can contract itself, keep the attention only on just a few things or perhaps one thing. It is quite an extraordinary thing when you think of it. And further, it is dual in its nature, that is to say, in its movement. It turns outward to the external world, or it can turn inward to its own memories, its ideas and emotions. That is what we call his objective and subjective. We use these terms, perhaps not fully understanding what they mean. But nevertheless, we see that the mind, the consciousness, can turn to the memories of experiences which took place in the past and which are still there, imprinted upon it. And it is the attachment to the memories which causes the desire to experience again. It is the attachment to the memories. If you don't know what something is, you cannot possibly desire it or fear it. It is absolutely the unknown. You don't know its nature. But you may say, yes, there is something unknown, I fear it. Yes, because it reminds you, there is a similarity between that and something else which is in your memory, and you have had a bad experience with it, and the fear is ingrained in you, therefore you fear the unknown. The fear of the unknown, so-called, is really a reflection of the fear of the known. It is really a projection. So in the same way, desire. It is only the attachment to particular experiences, to particular contacts, sensations, gratifications which we have had, that causes a desire for the repetition of those experiences. You know, desire is repetitive. You have a desire, the mind goes back to it, you get a certain satisfaction, but in the process of getting the satisfaction, you only strengthen not only the sensation which is in the memory, but the very attachment to that sensation. So the desire starts over again. And over and over again, it is never quenched by indulgence or satisfaction. But it takes a long time for a person to realize it. To speak about it is one thing, perfectly to realize it is another. And it is this desire to repeat experience which we have had, or the repetitive tendency of our memories, I put it like that, which causes reincarnation. That's the whole cause of it. It's a kind of drive into conditions where the thirst for experience can be satisfied. Of course, it is never satisfied. So the whole process of reincarnation is, to some extent, a process which takes place under a certain illusion. But the individual is still subject to illusions. That is why he reincarnates. If he had no illusions, he won't reincarnate. Now, according to my understanding, this is just a qualified way of stating. Memory is not a faculty, because a faculty is a capacity for action in a particular mode. It is similar to a technique. When you have a practice technique, you can perform very quickly and efficiently. So when you have a faculty, it is like a technique. I don't say it's a technique. A faculty is a capacity for action in a particular mode. But I don't think the memory is like that. I think it is in the nature of consciousness itself. The very nature of consciousness, it is sensitivity. Therefore it is sensitive. It receives impressions. And it has this extraordinary quality of retaining them, because the medium is of that nature. Therefore, I think it is in the nature of consciousness itself. Life, when you think of life in any form, it is really a succession of states. I am in one state at this moment. Next moment, next moment. It's a succession of states. The state at each moment arising from the state at the previous moment. It's really certain modification of the one state which results in the next state. So it's a modified continuity, and this process of change is kept going by causation, as I said a little while ago, cause and effect. In the realm of matter, in the realm of mechanics, everything takes place according to the inexorable law of cause and effect. So the change is mechanical. The change which takes place ordinarily in us, that is what I mean, is mechanical. And mechanism belongs to matter. We don't know what matter is. Anyhow, we have a certain idea of it. And we see that all things of matter move according to the law of cause and effect. And consciousness, in its unawareness, becomes mechanical. So, in the field of matter, it is mechanism which prevails. But in the field of consciousness also, when there is a state of unawareness, when it doesn't perceive what is taking place, it acts mechanically, blindly, instinctively. It is not consciousness, it is not matter, but it becomes and acts like matter. It is moldable. You know, you can take a child and mold its thinking. No child is born as a Roman Catholic or communist or anything else. A child is just a child. But you know, you can take the child consciousness and mold it as you like. You can indoctrinate it, you can shape it, you can make it like this thing or not like that thing, and so on. It is moldable, like clay. Here again we see the likeness between a material substance, clay, and consciousness, which is altogether of a different nature, but in a state of awareness, it can be molded, it can be influenced, and we are all being influenced by the newspapers and the radio and the broadcasters the whole time, influenced by our friends, influenced by the association, by our associations, in so many ways, constantly being influenced. So we have to understand how far we are merely echoing the views of other people, or we are reacting as they react. And it stays in the mold. It's not only molded, it stays in the mold. It becomes attached to the mold. It likes the mold. It just wants to be that. A Catholic wants to be a Catholic, a communist wants to be a communist, and perhaps a theosophist wants to be a theosophist. This may not be a true comparison. I don't mean a theosophist in a real sense. Theosophist so-called, that is what I mean. If you are a real theosophist, your mind is free. It is free. It's free of attachment. You don't fall for sensation. There is no tendency merely to go along with those things which you like and away from those things which you don't like. But that is real theosophy. It's a divine wisdom, spiritual, transcendent, extraordinarily pure, untainted. But we don't possess that. We just call ourselves theosophists. We have registered our name somewhere. And so we are all theosophists, including myself. Now, the whole question is, can we separate ourselves from the mold into which we have allowed ourselves to be poured, from the conditioning that has taken place, from all the ideas which are entrenched, all the habitual ways of thinking, all the grooves, the ruts, the habitual behavior. So, can we in some way free ourselves from this whole network of memory, so to say, by which our action in the field of consciousness is determined? Can we get out of this shell which has been formed around us? That's the whole question. You can say how memories are part of our own being. Still, the memory is an imprint. It is external to the pure consciousness. And the memories, suppose you perceive your memory as a memory. I have a certain image in my mind at this moment. Normally, it would be called subjective because it is within myself. That's a very rough way of using the word subjective. But I perceive this image in my mind. So the image is an object, is it not? It's an object of perception. Similarly, all the imprints on my consciousness are objects of perception. And the moment you separate yourself from those imprints, they all become object, like the external world. And the subject is away from all that, and that's the pure subject, the pure consciousness, the undefiled, the untouched, unprocessed, unconditioned, and eternally unconditioned. And it is only the pure consciousness, freed from every attachment, every bondage, that can know the truth. The truth of what exists, what takes place. Truth about all things in nature. The truth about ourselves. The truth about life. Truth about consciousness. Everything. Well, what is beauty? Is beauty a mere matter of conditioning? One person likes a red dress, another likes a blue dress. You see, this liking, of course there may be something deeper than that, but generally we like what we are conditioned to like. I like South Indian food. I may or may not like it. I'm saying it this moment. I like South Indian food because I am accustomed to it. I'm conditioned to like it. I've been eating it from my earliest days, so I like it. You like something else. Why do you like that? This liking is merely a matter of conditioning, what you have got accustomed to. It is just that. It is nothing more important than that. So you see, our likes and dislikes are largely the product of conditioning. Similarly, somebody says this is beautiful, another person says no, it is not beautiful. Who is to decide? People generally say no, it's a matter of taste, or perhaps it cannot be decided. In these matters, each one is a law unto himself. Is that so? Maybe. Or is there such a thing? Is there a way by which we can know what is truly beautiful and not what is only beautiful, so-called? Beautiful because we happen to like it. It's pleasurable. It's gratifying to us. You know, when a person is under the strong influence of desire, he will, and suppose he has to consort with something ugly in order to gain the gratification that he wants, the ugly will seem beautiful to him. This is a psychological phenomenon. Every kind of desire casts its own light, which is a very deceptive light. But I think there is true beauty, which can only be known to that consciousness which is pure, which is free from all condition. It just knows what is beautiful. Whatever seems beautiful to it is beautiful. In itself is the absolute canon of beauty, the test of truth, the test of virtue, the test of morality, the test of all those things which are beautiful in more than the physical sense. So it is, we have to gain that condition to know the truth for ourselves, the truth and the pure truth and nothing but the truth.